talking about the servicers themselves, and clearly they're a key partner in all of this. But their focus has been multiple focuses. They focused first on a collection of mortgages or loans before they become foreclosed on. And secondly, once they are foreclosed, then they deal with the vacancy issue. How are they balancing their workload? How much growth have you seen in the community? How much stress? And with all that said, how do you get them at the table?
Well, you know, that private alliance still does hear from the Treasury Department and others, and how are you doing and how is your progress? I will tell you, I'm very impressed with the alignment and the engagement at the most senior levels across this whole alliance. I mean, we'll have a call, we'll have a fly-in and get the CEOs or one of the top three people in on almost every participant. It's real. And so the good news is engaged people will keep marching in the same direction. I think two is focusing on those quick wins. So if we really have done a lot to slow down some of the foreclosures in the toughest neighborhoods, but you know what? They're not winning on this one. One out of two loans now go to foreclosure. When I looked at the data first, it was about one third of the loans ended up in foreclosure. So that's a difficult issue in the declining markets. I talked to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and asked them what their statistics were on abandoned houses going to foreclosure, and it's very high. So this is just a complicated continuing effort, and we need to stabilize the market. I think it's been a struggle, clearly, and we've worked pretty hard to get commitments on capacity and reworking workflow so that you're not just collecting payments, but you really have a strong commitment to home preservation and looking at all the alternatives early on in the process at the servicing departments, and many of them have tremendous operations and have reshifted their resources accordingly. But the REO, as was mentioned earlier, is the new surge, and here we are working hard on preventing the foreclosures, and of course it's a new focus. And I'm sure folks like Chase this afternoon who are speaking and others can share with you how they've dealt with that and reallocated their resources.
I'd like to add to that. I think it would have been far more difficult for those of us working in the Stabilization Trust to really engage with senior managers at the servicers had it not been for the Hope Now Alliance, really establishing a forum for servicers to not only talk with each other, but also to talk with the housing counseling organizations. And very early on, both Faith and Eileen Fitzgerald from NeighborWorks, which was coordinating since the very beginning closely with the Hope Now Alliance, said, you know, make sure that we're talking about all the issues, that we don't say, okay, we've got to have a whole new group of people to talk with about REO. And so some of the leaders from the lead servicing organizations really bridged that gap, began coming to the forums that were called together by the OCC, and really made common cause in trying to come up with solutions to the problems and not just talk about the problems. I'd say another thing that we did early on was really to try to understand the situation from the servicer's point of view and not, vilify them. There was plenty of that going around. That said, it's still very tough for mayors and heads of redevelopment authorities and nonprofits to not get angry about the fact that it is often very difficult to call a servicer and try to talk about one property or a handful of properties on a certain block. And so that was really at the core of what was behind the trust, is to try to bridge that gap between those two groups of organizations, both of which are working very hard, both of which are trying to grapple with unprecedented numbers of properties and trying to get a better place for them to exchange information.
Maybe I could just add a couple of things. I think there is a overload. I think I don't think it's quite panic, but I think there really is a crisis situation. I think I mentioned that some people are saying, well, make us an offer kind of thing. The problem is we aren't making offers because we don't want the properties with the current market situation. So that's a big, big problem. I think there is more looking forward. I think even a few months ago, people were still looking to the past and say, well, the value is this, it should be this, and not realizing what the real market value was in those micro markets, because you look at the big market, the city of Chicago or the metropolitan area or whatever you're looking at, you know, people look at that number and they don't look at the micro market in terms of what's really going on in those hard hit places. So that data information responding, looking forward into the real time information right now rather than even 2 or 3 or 4 months ago, which values were high. Excuse me. But I mean, I think that's a big, big issue.
Okay. I have 2 questions that are actually pretty different. So the first one is for Faith. And in talking to the folks at the FDIC, they tell me that they really believe that they made major progress in the IndyMac situation because the letters they sent out said, this is your new mortgage payment. It had an absolute offer. You know, subject only to the verification of income. And I'm just wondering whether anybody else that you know of is going to try something similar. And then I guess for the others, mainly Mary, you talked about getting local housing organizations in collaboration with state and local governments to do all this. And yet we know that marvelous as your 4 owners, partners are, the capacity is limited. Where does the private sector come in, private developers?
Sure. I think there's a fair amount of innovation around direct offers going out wherever the investors allow such a thing on a streamlined way. We as an alliance have studied already how the FDIC is doing, engaged with IndyMac FDIC to tell us more and brief us on how that's working, what have they done, what are their results. Recently, there's a Bank of America countrywide settlement, fairly prescriptive on outcomes. We've had several meetings already over both of those, and then looking at what else can be done, just more streamlined, stepping back from the market. I can honestly say it's not a one-size-fits-all when you get that prescriptive, and 27 banks, majority of the, you know, the subprime prime market coverage makes for lots of different investors and different outcomes. But I can tell you, even one of the GSEs told me that they have a streamlined mod with that offering out. Remarkable offer on a very streamlined pilot, and they have a 20% response rate. So remember those letters I talked about? Remember that lack of response on 2 million letters that have gone out? We're dealing with a pretty unprecedented issue, even if you have the best offers out. So I'm anxious to see, and I think they've done had great leadership, the FDIC, on what they've done. I think the alliance will get somewhere to get better at more streamlined efforts, but it takes every investor to be at the table to allow that.
And on Ellen's second question of how do you really build the capacity, how do you bring the private sector to the table when you are pretty aware that with all of the nonprofit and public capacity working at full tilt, it won't be enough. And the slide that I showed from Minneapolis is at least a first step in beginning to demonstrate a recognition of that. And I know early on, City of Chicago, MacArthur Foundation got people together early this year and said, well, you know, the nonprofits and the city are not going to solve this problem alone. Now, saying it and getting it done are 2 very different things. But as we've begun to talk about the real numbers of properties that are going to have to be dealt with, even in very targeted neighborhoods, there's a pretty quick recognition that nonprofit developers alone are not going to solve the problem. And while the embracing of either individual homeowners and getting them tools such as acquisition rehab mortgages, or whether it's small for-profit rehab contractors who are willing to work under a set of prescribed criteria where they might not have worked under those criteria if business was a little better, but when business is not so good, they're maybe a little more willing to deal with issues like income limitations, et cetera, in return for being able to keep some work going. So the sheer number of properties and a focused discussion about how are we possibly going to deal with enough properties to bring those neighborhoods back across the tipping point, really, in my estimation, have forced the discussion that would have been hard to have even a year ago about bringing individual homeowners and small private developers into the mix.
I just reiterate, I think one way to perhaps do that is developing financing tools that would be available to those small developers, and then have the monitoring and the connection there, which I think in Chicago, you know, we're looking at that. And, of course, Shore Bank and CIC and others could be places where you could do that, where we'll have contacts with developers who, you know, have the experience and could perhaps take on X number of properties to do within a design program.
Yeah, Bruce, you mentioned that as properties were coming out of foreclosure and going on in the marketplace, there seems to be a market clearing price. The first entity, the first player that comes in are investors who aren't necessarily, don't have the best interest of this neighborhood stabilization in mind. And so there is obviously a market clearing price of some sort that brings those players in the marketplace before the people who might have the best interest of the neighborhood in mind. What's that delta? What's the difference in those two sets of prices? And what kind of subsidy or what other kinds of factors would be necessary, or scale would be necessary to make that delta go away?
Good question. I think it's a changing situation. I referred to investors before who were buying properties at, I would say it used to be a year or two ago, they would be paying, you know, $40,000-$50,000 more than we would be willing to pay for a property that would sell eventually for $150,000 or $200,000. They'd pay $50,000. We want to pay $25,000. So there was a big difference. That was when financing was available to those speculators, you know, who are speculator homeowners. Their financing was anyway subprime. Now that financing really isn't very available. I don't think there's many investors, speculators out there. And I think the price, as you could see from the slides, you know, there were very low priced properties that have not been sold to those investors because, you know, it's just, there are two things. One, the difficulty of finding the financing for them to get it because they usually need financing. Secondly, they don't know what the end price is either and who's going to buy it or who's going to rent it or how they're going to manage the economics of the current situation. So I don't know that.
Is credit crunch a good time to be?
Well, it's a good time for now if you had patient long-term capital, you know, and you could absorb the costs and the risks going forward. And I think that's the basic NSP question model. How do you develop it so that you're doing something that gets those low, you know, prices now, factors in how you manage that going forward and have the patience to deal with the problem and have really some affordability going forward, but it costs money.
I'd like to add to that comment that it's a tough conversation oftentimes to have at the local level where you may have very good nonprofit developers who will take a very reasoned approach to the redevelopment of a property. They'll take a look at, okay, what's it going to cost me to rehab it? What can I sell it for? And then that back into the, okay, what can I pay for the property? And, you know, you often reach a number somewhere close to or below zero when you approach the property in that way. And when you have the conversation with the community groups that says, well, you know, zero may be what you want to pay for that property, but the problem is I have a bid for $20,000 from an investor owner who will come in, do a paint up, fix up, and bring tenants in. So recognizing that although you may not think of it as a legitimate market bid, that alternative bid is there, and you really need to make some decisions at the local level whether you're willing to buy it, you know, at roughly that same price and bring the subsidy dollars to the table to close that gap.
Can I add something? In that instance, too, if I recollect, I think the servicer's obligation is to go with a higher price. Is that true to the investor? And so that complication is part of that equation as well. If it has MI on it or different investors, that's kind of the clearing.
I wanted to go back to your end of the spectrum, Faith. I think what I heard in the combined conversations is that you've sent out about 2 million letters and got about a 20% return, and that even with the IndyMac best price offer, they're still only getting about a 20% return.
I don't know what theirs is. I just know of another pilot right now with a predetermined offer, much, much lower, maybe 30 or 40% lower than the payment today, and it's only getting a 20% response. Okay. So I just, these are tough issues.
So having said that, what analysis or assessment have you all done or your constituent servicers done about what would it take to increase the response rate on the theory that I think early on you said if we could actually talk to most borrowers, mm-hmm. there might be a lot more that could be done with them. So how do we stop more getting into the foreclosure pipeline?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Come join our committees. You know, we have been comprehensive. I mean, starting back with NeighborWorks and their ad campaign, I'm pleased to see that when you turn on TV at any time, I'm always seeing the ads now of there's nothing worse than doing nothing. There were 6 servicers out of 27 that had 800 numbers for housing counselors. They're not used to talking to housing counselors as another avenue to bring in borrowers when they're flooded with their borrowers. And not getting through the 800 numbers. Now, I'm dialing back a year today. Everyone has 800 numbers, faxes, and emails. It's not perfect. I get the complaints. Everyone has my email. But it's much better. Commitment to responding to borrowers who inquire. It's often possibly the case. We've seen the Freddie Mac study, the Roper study, where borrowers think there's nothing that can be done at the lender level, period. 57%. That's a terrible statistic. So we are trying to change that at a national scale. Every congressman and senator and mayor has gotten a letter on how to reach out and have on their website a way to reach an 888-995 number and then get back into the servicing shops. And I think the heightened awareness is absolutely there. Door hangers have been approved, letters to non-contact borrowers, outreach events with people like the Federal Reserve. That's a big deal. People respond. The mayor of Boston was on the radio 2 hours before that event started, and I'm sure that brought in hundreds of extra people. So we do work with the local and federal government to heighten awareness. We work with our critics who say, they do nothing. Bring them in, bring them under the tent, because if they're there, then a lot more people will come. So, we're very diverse, transparent, and encouraging to partner innovative, in innovative ways. That's all I know how to do. So thanks.